Appaloosa Radio presents an original audio story. Echoes of Barbara Mandrell. A work of fiction. Echoes of Barbara Mandrell. Charles was trapped in a perpetual gray fog that clouded his memories and his senses. In his private room overlooking the well-tended rose garden of the Oak Knoll Memory Care Facility, the days were identical. The day shift nursing assistant would greet him cheerfully, help him into the shower, dress him with the clothes that his oldest daughter, Roxanne, had purchased for him, and fasten him securely in his special electric wheelchair. Charles never objected to the routine, nor did he show curiosity or interest in it. Non-responsive, she would write in the morning nursing notes. Once he was secured in his chair, the nursing assistant would use its high-tech remote controls to guide him to the dining room. A little like driving a remote-controlled toy car, she thought. In the dining room, she would cajole and encourage a bite or two. But, despite her sincere efforts, it would never be much. After breakfast, she would bring him back to his room, where she would brush his teeth and comb his wild shock of white hair. She would chat with him, but he wouldn't reply. He wouldn't say anything. He never looked at her. He never looked at anything. She would wheel him to the day room, where a large screen television blared game shows and a never-ending series of commercials. Some of the other guests would occasionally react to what was happening on the television. Not Charles. He would sit in uninterrupted silence, motionless, his eyes hollow, his mouth shut, his hands limp, never saying a word, never interacting with anyone. The staff would write in the nursing notes, expressionless, non-communicative, no improvement. Then, one afternoon, the perpetual gray fog disappeared. Charles started singing with a rich baritone voice that carried down the hall and filled the entire facility. The head nurse immediately called his daughter with the news. Roxanne responded, "Amazing. Did you know that he once sang with Barbara Mandrell?" It would have been impolite to ask, but the head nurse privately wondered, who was Barbara Mandrell? And why was that so special? However, there was a time in the late 1970s when everyone would instantly know who Barbara Mandrell was. She was a country music superstar, and her television show reached the top 5 of the Nielsen ratings. More importantly, everyone would immediately recognize a typical Barbara Mandrell song. The title said everything you need to know. Married, but not to each other. Lovers, friends, and strangers. After the lovin'. Our bedroom reunion. Sleeping single in a double bed. If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right. She was vivacious and beautiful, but not sexy. Her audience was overwhelmingly female, and she drew more fans from the suburbs than from the Grand Ole Opry. Indeed, the fact that Charles had once sung with Barbara Mandrell was a big deal, but a big deal now hidden in the foggy gray recesses of Charles' mind.
Roll camera.
I want camera 2 on her, not the band. No one gives a sheet of toilet paper about them. They want to see Barbara Mandrell. It is her show. Do a 3/4 shot. Now, move her up a half step. I want that glittery background just before her. Wide. Then, switch to camera 1. Frontal. Tight shot. Right into those baby blue eyes. Probably a good take. Let's look at the tape to see if we got it. If not, then we'll do it again from the top. Everyone take 10. Smoke and pee break.
Gus Griswold always yelled. He thought that was what television directors do. They yell at people. And he wanted everyone to hear him the first time. Don't waste my time making me say it again. His constant yelling bothered both Barbara and her younger sister Louise. They were Southern women, not used to his coarse Brooklyn vulgarity. So, Barbara brought him into her dressing room for a private chat. Use a quiet, assertive voice. Speak clearly. Show respect. Yelling doesn't make things go more smoothly. However, Gus Griswold was old school. Not the genteel, have a cup of tea, British old school. No. He was straight from the streets of Brooklyn old school. Always yelled, always. And 90 of every 100 words was a profanity. Not just one profanity, but always a long string of profanities. He constantly spewed profanities. Loudly, very loudly. Usually all of the 8 forbidden words strung together into a single sentence. More accurately, a long repetitive sentence, with the 8 forbidden words repeated multiple times. Each sentence was followed by another sentence with the same structure. Then another, and another. Louise once suggested to her older sister that they set up a cussin jar. Every time Gus Griswold says the nasty word, he would have to put a nickel in. Louise could not even say the word. The word. It was so terrible, so forbidden. Barbara liked the idea. Except, she said, it would have to be a whole lot larger than a jar. Maybe a 55-gallon oil drum. That's only a couple 100,000 nickels. He'd fill that in a couple of weeks. Barbara giggled at the thought. You know, he'd probably go broke, even if it was only 5 cents each time. Louise also laughed at the thought. He would be utterly penniless, perpetually broke, even if Gus Griswold had to fork over only a nickel every time. Barbara never got a cussin jar. However, on multiple occasions, she told him that she did not appreciate such language around her. Please speak to people in a polite, civilized manner. Show a little kindness. Gus promised he would try. He told her that he came from a place where everyone yelled at everyone else all the time. He had yelled at people his whole life. Profanity? Nothing personal. That just was the way we talk where I grew up. Just like when Southerners say, y'all. Still, Gus Griswold could produce successful television shows, and he was very good at his craft. And he had always yelled at everyone on every set on which he had worked, all the time. Yet, to please Barbara, he would try. He liked her, everybody did. Hell, everyone in America loved her. That's why her show was number 4 in the ratings. Still, Gus would try. After all, a little politeness never hurt anyone. Thank you. Charles James Day, III, never liked Gus Griswold. He reminded Charles of his old drill sergeant in the Marines. 2.5 of the worst years of his life. The United States Marines. The only good thing about being a Marine was that he went to Korea to guard the DMZ instead of Vietnam. No one shot at him in Seoul. It was in Seoul at a USO show that he first saw Barbara Mandrell and her sisters. They were not the headliners, just a filler act. Still, he loved her voice, and her perky style. That really wowed him. He told his buddy from Tennessee, "Someday, that Barbara Mandrell is really going to be something, really something." His buddy took another drag on his joint, closed his eyes, and said, "Yeah, man, really something."
Y'all enjoying San Francisco? I tell you, there ain't no other place like it. And you're here at the incomparable Hungry Eye. There ain't no other place like it either. Tonight is open mic night at the Eye, and I've got 9 of you cats on my list. So, listen to the best new talent that the city by the bay can offer. Next cat that I have on my list is Charlie Day. Come on up to the stage, Charlie. What will you do for us tonight?
I'm from Texas and I play the steel guitar, Hawaiian style, and I sing. I'd like to do a song I heard while I was in the Marines in Seoul, Korea. It is a song that I heard Barbara Mandrell sing.
Welcome to NBC Studios. This is an open casting call for country musicians to perform behind a band of puppets developed by Sid and Marty Croft for the new Barbara Mandrell Music Hour. The puppets, Truck Shackley and the Texas Critters, will perform country music alongside Barbara in each episode. The segments will provide lighthearted comedy for the show. The musicians selected must choreograph their music precisely with the actions of the puppets.
Charlie, could you join my road manager Ken Dudney and me in my dressing room for a few minutes? We have something we want to talk to you about. Thanks, Charlie, for talking with us. You know Ken, my husband and my road manager. He is the details guy for our organization. We make every decision together. Charlie, doing this television thing is really exhausting. Ken and I have decided to give it up. Instead, we've decided to return to doing only live concerts. Doing 70 or 80 shows a year. We've already mapped out our itinerary. Charlie, I'd like you to join my touring band, the Do-Rights. You're good on the steel guitar, and I think you could handle a solid bass guitar. I like the way that you're always with me on beat with every song. So, the question is, do you want to join us on the road?
Kara, I am asking you to be my wife, to be with me forever.
Charles James Day III, I love you and want to bear your children. However, I will not raise a family in the back of Barbara Mandrell's tour bus. You've got to give up performing in the Due Rites. Settle down. With a proper home. I've already talked to my father. He is willing to bring you into his real estate development company. He says that if you are willing to work hard, there's plenty of money to be made. Lots of opportunities.
Hello, this is Mrs. Roxanne Rogers. I am returning Dr. Larner's call. I understand that he wants my consent to give my father, Charles Day, an experimental drug. I believe that he said it was called Nostalgen 16.
Mrs. Rogers, Nostalgen 16 is an experimental compound that is meant to rebuild neurological pathways damaged by trauma and restore lost memories. It stimulates regrowth of dendritic spines which store memories. It administers deep brain stimulation to target very precise regions linked to long-term memory formation and storage. Mrs. Rogers, we believe that Nostalgen 16 can bring your father back to the person he was. It can rebuild the memories that have been lost. We believe that we will see almost immediate results. However, we are still in the very early stages of testing. If you give us permission, your father, Charles, will be the 29th person to receive this treatment. We believe that its side effects are benign, but cannot say for sure since we are still early in our studies. Without it, I see no hope about your father recovering from his present condition.
Every morning after breakfast, the 84-year-old former musician sat motionless in his special electric wheelchair in the sunny day room, wholly oblivious to all that surrounded him. He would sit in uninterrupted silence, his eyes hollow, his mouth shut, his hands limp. Never saying a word, never interacting with anyone. Not even when the eminent doctor from the nearby university and his various research assistants drew vials of blood, collected DNA hair samples, studied his urine and feces, and finally strapped a strange contraption on his head. He did not respond to the beeps and tweets of the various medical instruments that now surrounded him. He asked no questions, sought no answers, expressed no expectations. Passively unresponsive. Unresponsive. Not responsive. No responses. So the perpetual grayness lifted with the briefest glimpses of memory. A few bars of a song, a remembered key change, the bright sequins reflecting off a sparkling dress, a crowd roaring approval, stage lights, too bright, a small woman, tiny in even her tallest high heels, a drummer who always needed a cigarette before he could begin a set, cowboy boots. Barbara always wanted her guys to wear shiny boots. Had to shine them before every performance. Then the song came. One that he had sung hundreds of times. Always in every show. It was her most famous song. One that everyone knew. one that every audience would always sing along with the band. Hey, I was country when country wasn't cool. Yeah, and I was country from my hat to, whoa, my boots. I still act and look the same. What you see ain't nothing new. 'Cause I was country when country wasn't cool. Yeah, I was country when it wasn't cool. Then, there was Barbara Mandrell, bowing to the audience, throwing kisses. It was a wrap. They would be on the bus in an hour. Ken would see to that. Time to sleep before the next place. Before doing the same show again. Always ended with the same song. Always. Always. One afternoon, something changed. The fog in his mind lifted, and Charles remembered. He remembered who he was, what he had done, and who he had loved. He remembered his voice, his passion, and his music. He remembered Barbara Mandrell. He began to sing. He sang with a rich baritone that resonated through the hall and touched everyone who heard it. He sang the songs he had sung with her, the songs that everyone always knew. The songs of broken hearts, imperfect relationships, and promises never kept. The head nurse heard him and ran to the day room. She saw him singing, his face alive, his eyes sparkling, his hands waving. She was amazed. She took out her phone and called his daughter, Roxanne. Amazing! Did you know that he once sang with Barbara Mandrell? Charles zoomed his special motorized wheelchair along the hallways of the Oak Knoll Memory Care Facility, as if he was still behind the wheel of his bright red Mercedes. He dodged the slower-moving obstacles in his way, enjoying the thrill of speed. The staff watched him in awe. Just a week ago, he had been essentially vegetative, motionless in silence, oblivious to all that surrounded him. Now he was a buzzing mass of perpetual energy, full of vitality and vigor. He no longer was passively unresponsive. He had developed interests, opinions, and demands. He insisted to the head nurse that he was ready to leave the prison of the memory care facility. "Unlock the doors and let me out." Dr. Larner and his research team were thrilled with Charles' progress. They had given him only 2 doses of Nostalgin 16. Other patients had needed more. And Charles' condition had been the worst they had ever seen. Nostalgin 16 could revolutionize the field of psychiatric neuroscience and memory loss disease. Dr. Larner and his research team had demonstrated that Nostalgin 16 promotes the growth of new dendritic spines and restores patient memories. Roxanne Rogers had endured 3 years of difficulty. Her mother's cancer had taken a toll on her, since Roxanne was the only one who could take care of her while her sisters lived far away. She had watched her mother suffer through endless chemotherapy treatments and finally hospice until she passed away peacefully. Then, she had to cope with her father's memory disease. She had to find a suitable facility for him and monitor his condition. To make matters worse, her oldest son, Jeffrey, who was a college sophomore, had been arrested on DUI charges, and Roxanne had to bail him out from jail and find a lawyer for him. He was now living back at home until the court proceedings were finished, but he was not happy with the situation. Now, she faced another dilemma. Her father, Charles, wanted to leave the locked security of the memory care facility. He claimed that he had recovered his memory, thanks to the experimental Nostalgin 16 treatments. She consulted with Dr. Larner, who confirmed that Charles had shown remarkable improvement, but cautioned that it might not last. He warned her that Charles could still pose a risk to himself or others if he relapsed into his previous state. Her father was insistent. He adamantly demanded his freedom and refused to stay in prison. She agonized over her decision for weeks. Finally, she agreed to let him move to a different part of the Oak Knoll facility, where he would have his own apartment, but with regular checkups from the staff. Still, Roxanne was not sure if she had done the right thing. She visited him every day, at random times, to see how he was doing. Dr. Larner continued to be optimistic. He said that the prognosis looked promising. It appeared as if Charles was getting back to his old self. In early 1985, Barbara Mandrell and her two children were returning home, driving on a road that she knew well, when a 19-year-old, who was driving at a high rate of speed on the wrong side of the road, hit her car head-on. The teenager was killed, and Barbara Mandrell, the country superstar, was seriously injured. For days, she was on life support, and then she spent years recovering from the accident. Fortunately, her children were unharmed. In a later court hearing, it was alleged that the 19-year-old was both high on marijuana and had earlier been at a party where he consumed a number of beers. When Charlie Day, now Charles, received Ken's horrific phone call, he immediately bought a plane ticket and flew directly to Nashville, where he spent several days at Barbara's bedside, in constant prayer for her full recovery. After 3.5 days, she opened her eyes, turned her head, and gave him a familiar wink. That head turn and wink was her signal to the band that she wanted to do the chorus again from the top. A singer's signal that only the band guys knew. That was also her signal to Charlie that it was okay for him to go home. She was out of danger and on her road to eventual recovery. Before returning to Houston, Charles offered to pay all of Barbara's hospital and recuperation expenses. During the previous year, from developing new commercial properties, Charles had cleared his first million. He knew that other millions would swiftly come, so he could certainly afford it. However, Ken Dudney thanked him but said that would not be necessary, since his wife, Barbara Mandrell, was herself a multimillionaire. Charles Day never saw Barbara Mandrell again. They exchanged Christmas cards and birthday greetings, but never met in person. After she had recovered enough to perform, Ken and Barbara made the decision to stop doing road tours. Instead, they built a permanent theater in Branson, Missouri, where she performed twice a day, 4 days a week, always ending every show with the song, "I Was Country When It Wasn't Cool."
I never saw Barbara Mandrell again. Never. not once. We exchanged Christmas cards and birthday greetings and occasionally talked briefly on the phone, but never met in person. I think she wanted it that way. But never met in person. I think she wanted it that way. But never met in person. I think she wanted it that way. But never met in person. I think she wanted it that way.
The senior apartment that Charles Day now occupied in the massive Oak Knoll complex was small by Texas standards, but Roxanne felt it was adequate since it also included full meal service and access to a recreational hall. One of the several positive changes that the Nostalgen 16 treatment had brought was that Charles could now briefly stand by himself. Standing meant that Charles could now both take himself to the bathroom and dress himself. Although his taste in clothing was not always what Roxanne preferred. Whenever she visited him, Roxanne would adjust his wardrobe to her own taste. "He would wear the same flannel pajamas all the time if I would let him," she told her sisters. Clothing choices aside, Roxanne was pleased with the progress she was seeing. Her father was eating and had actually gained a few pounds. A very good thing, she thought. He had been just skin and bones. Good morning. Morning, Mr. Day. This is Monica, your occupation therapist. Just checking in on you. Are you coming down to the dining room for breakfast, or should I have the kitchen staff bring it up to you? Monica's voice came through the intercom located next to the apartment's door. At first, the intercom confused Charles. He did not realize that you must flip the blue switch up to talk on it. He tried to talk back to it. When no one responded, he tried again. Then again, in a loud, angry voice. Realizing his confusion, Monica came to his apartment and showed him how the system worked. At least, she thought she had shown him. Unfortunately, the next day, Charles demonstrated the same frustrations, and Monica came to his apartment and showed him again. "Something so simple. I don't know why he does not grasp it," she commented to her teammates. Monica did not know that Charles understood how to use the intercom. He had simply chosen not to. Every time he flipped the blue switch up, someone spoke to him. Someone he detested. Someone from his past. Someone whose voice replaced his own.
"Don't be such a stupid toothpick. The band is supposed to synchronize with the puppets. When the puppet drummer lowers his stick to his puppet drum, then you must strike your real drum. Not 10 minutes later. Got it? You are the puppet's sound effect. I know that you have a watermelon for a brain. So let me explain. See, the puppets can't really make music. It is your job to make music for them. The key word here is synchronize. Say it with me. Sync. Crow. Nice. That means at the same time." "Zip up your pants and get with it. It is your fault that we are still rehearsing the same segment at 7:30 at night. It is your fault that none of us have gotten supper. It is also your fault that no one has been able to get to the privy. That everyone is holding it tight, crossing their legs because of you. But we'll stay here until everyone gets it right, and no one sneaks away to the John. I will not put garbage on the air. No, not on my show. We'll get it right. Exactly. Precisely. Got it?"
It seemed like an echo from the distant past, but Charles kept hearing Gus Griswold's voice. Just like back when they were taping the television show.
"He hated to do right. Those puppets. Those damnable puppets. That was his way of sneering at us. always sneering at us. Sneering. He wasn't country, and he wasn't cool.
But never met in person. I think she wanted it that way. But never met in person. I think she wanted it that way.
No, I never saw Barbara again. Never. Never. I always remember her on that hospital bed. Helpless, tubes everywhere, destroyed, ruined. Never saw her again. Never. Not once. Never. Why didn't we reconnect after she started performing again? Must have been a reason. Why? I don't know why. Oh yeah. Yeah. It is because of Gus Griswold. Yeah. That gross little man with a dark, fuzzy beard. Always spouting profanities. Always yelling. Never could speak civilly to her. Never showed any respect. Nasty. Polluted. Evil. He never wanted her to bring the band back. He hated the Do Rights. Those puppets. Those damnable puppets. That was his way of sneering at us. Always sneering at us. Sneering. He wasn't country, and he wasn't cool.
One of Dr. Larner's graduate students first noticed the anomaly. She found it in 25 of the 29 patients treated with Nostalgin 16. The emotional centers of the brain were being stimulated at a rate 17.5% higher than expectations. The impact was most noticeable on the limbic cortex, which is directly involved in mood, motivation, and judgment. Nostalgin 16 was designed to rebuild neurological pathways damaged by trauma and memory disease. It restores lost memories by stimulating a regrowth of the dendritic spines which store memories. It had been expected that with Nostalgin 16 treatment, a patient's effect will be attenuated in a positive direction. They would feel better about themselves and have a more positive outlook on their circumstances. Thus, some impact on the brain's emotion centers had been assumed. However, that was assumed to be a simple, positive side effect as a result of successful memory restoration. Stimulation of the limbic cortex was not anticipated to be a primary effect. When the research team gathered to discuss this finding, Dr. Larner commented that a stimulation of the limbic cortex of this magnitude is like smoking a couple of pounds of hashish. And one of the graduate students added, or alternatively, taking a truckload of downers. All agreed that the Nostalgin 16 patients would experience very intense mood swings, going from the lowest low to the highest high. Positive feelings would be quickly replaced by negative ones. It would also impact decision-making. Finally, the research team noted the obvious. The limbic cortex does not act independently of the other regions of the brain. It is also connected to and coordinated with the amygdala and the hypothalamus. The amygdala is directly involved with fear and anger. It is triggered when there is a perception of danger, when there is a need to flee or fight. The hypothalamus has its own important role. It coordinates hormonal responses to stress. Given these new findings, Dr. Larner regretted his advice to Mrs. Rogers. Keeping her father in the secure memory care facility might have been the best alternative.
Hello,
This is Charles Day in room 4711. I would like to order a ham and cheese sandwich on rye bread mayo with Dijon mustard.
I'm sorry, Mr. Day, but it is almost midnight, and all of the kitchens are closed and locked.
Oh, I've been hankering for a ham and cheese on rye all day, really hankering for one. Maybe you could get me the fixings and I can make my own. I can even go down to the kitchen and get them, if you can't bring them up.
Okay, Mr. Day. Joe Fowler, our night janitor, says he'll open the kitchen and get you the sandwich fixings. You can meet him outside the main kitchen on level 2.
I'll see him there. Hi, Mr. Fowler. Thanks for doing this for me.
Sure, no problem. Our goal is to meet our guests' needs.
And you do that mighty well. Mr. Fowler disarmed the alarm system, unlocked the kitchen's stainless steel door, and entered the dimly lit kitchen. Charles followed slowly behind him in his motorized wheelchair. Then Mr. Fowler disappeared into the massive walk-in refrigerator. As soon as he entered the refrigerator, Charles accelerated his motorized wheelchair to maximum speed, opened the exterior door, zipped down the loading ramp, and disappeared into the massive parking lot. My escape was a lot easier than I thought it would be, he mused to himself as he fled into the city's darkness. Closing his eyes, Charlie could see every detail. Barbara and her band, the Do-Rights, were on stage in Ann Arbor, Michigan, performing in an arena designed for college basketball. 18,000 fans. Every seat sold. In his mind, he played the first few bars of their opening song, waiting for Barbara to make her appearance. She moves to center stage, wearing a long, sequined dress, shimmering blue, then green, then blue again. He can feel his guitar in his hands, feels the steel vibrate over the strings. It was a hot July night and the stage lights made it feel even warmer. Still, the moment was magic. His baritone voice harmonizing with her lilting melodies. He could see it. In every incredible detail. In every incredible detail. In every incredible detail. In every incredible detail. Then the voice came. The one that came through the intercom, the voice of Gus. Gus Griswold.
I have great power. You are nothing. You are weak. A studio musician. Easily replaceable. Nothing special. Backup performer to a bunch of puppets. I have decided to keep Barbara Mandrell. Keep her as my own. She can make me lots of money. Singing on television. Singing what I tell her. Stage concerts. No money there. Television. 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 I will never allow the Do-Rights to reconnect with Barbara Mandrell. You will never sing with her again. I have forces at my disposal to stop it. Sinister forces with great power, far greater than you have. Sinister forces because I am evil, wholly and completely evil. I can call upon dark forces. Sinister forces, I can stop you. I will silence you. I will stop you. I will stop you. I have great power. You are nothing. I have great power. Great power. You are nothing. 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 Great power.
Mrs. Ken Dudney left her home outside Nashville to take her two older children shopping. She decided to drive the Jaguar since it was bigger than her two-seat Mercedes. On their way home, a teenage driver crossed onto the wrong side of the road, traveling at a high rate of speed, and hit Mrs. Dudney head-on. The only thing that saved her life was that an instant before the crash, she made a hard left, so that the oncoming car crashed into the passenger side, away from her. Another factor that helped was that the Jaguar was built like a tank, with a massive engine and a solid steel frame. The other car was a smaller Japanese-built model, with a smaller mass. Nonetheless, her recuperation was both lengthy and painful. She withdrew from public view during it. Only after it was complete did her other persona, Barbara Mandrell, reemerge. In subsequent interviews, she often said that it was an act of divine providence that she lived. In thankfulness, she often performed gospel music during her shows. Those terrible events are now 37 years in the past. She is now living a pleasant life in her retirement. However, the unanticipated side effects from the Nostalgen 16 treatment had blocked Charles' ability to distinguish paranoia from reality. He was determined to complete his mission of saving her from the evil forces that sought to harm her, to save her from the evil clutches of Gus Griswold. The voice on the intercom said two words that motivated Charles into instantaneous action. The voice said, "Cactus Music," which Charles immediately knew was the oldest and largest independent record store in Houston. A fixture in the Houston music scene. One that every musician knew. Many had performed in-store music, casual jamming with other musicians who happened to be in town. Charles had often shopped there, never buying tapes or CDs. Always vinyl. Charlie remembered that Barbara Mandrell was coming to the store to sign autographs and to give an interview with a local radio station. It had been on her calendar for months. What a perfect place for Gus to kidnap her. The thought of Gus kidnapping her sent cold shivers down Charlie's spine. Kidnap her and force her to perform on television. Charlie knew that the fastest way to get to the Cactus Music Store was to use the West Park Tollway, the famous Texas 8 superhighway. Texas 8 was a toll road. Many Texans believed that since they had paid their toll, there was no speed limit on the roadway. That belief was so common that a local maxim emerged, Texas 8, where the fools drive like hell demons and the wise ones just pray. Using the Texas 8 tollway meant risking it all to get where you needed to go. However, Charlie was on a mission of maximum urgency. So, the Texas 8 tollway was the only option. The only way to get to Cactus Music and to foil Gus.
A NewsNow alert from Houston's NewsNow station, where local Texas news comes first.
This is D. Nelia Robinson with a News Now Action Alert. From alongside the busy West Park Tollway, the infamous Texas 8. I am standing right where the West Park Tollway exits onto Richmond Street, one of the busiest off-ramps on a very busy tollway. This was the scene of a very bizarre and extremely tragic accident that resulted in the death of an 84-year-old man suffering from dementia. I find it unbelievable even as I report this. The elderly man was driving his motorized wheelchair, and he had driven it almost 19 miles on the Texas 8 tollway where vehicles routinely whiz past doing 80 miles an hour. We've all heard the saying, if you're driving 80 on the 8, then you're driving too slow. Tollway officials have provided the News Now team video of this gentleman driving his motorized chair in the number 2 lane. See, there he is driving under the West Park toll gantry on the Texas 8. Unbelievable. See, the wheelchair is going pretty fast. Pretty fast, that is, for a motorized wheelchair. Maybe 20 miles an hour. But this is the notorious Texas 8 tollway. The word I am getting is that this gentleman had escaped from a care facility in the Cinco Ranch area. Somehow, he seems to have made it from Cinco Ranch onto the Grand Parkway Toll Road, then onto the West Park, Texas 8 tollway, traveling eastbound toward Houston. 19 miles, cars and truck buzzing by. Then, at the Richmond Street exit, he left the tollway. It was on the off-ramp that a semi-truck carrying a load of gravel hit and killed him. Officials have informed us that the driver of the semi-truck is not being cited. An unfortunate accident. Obviously, this elderly gentleman had some place he wanted to go, and he wanted to get there fast. So, he did what thousands of Texans do every day. He took the Texas 8 tollway, and then he let it rip. This is D. Nelia Robinson, returning you to the News Now studio.
Epilogue. Charlie knew that he was risking his life pushing his motorized wheelchair to its maximum capacity along the treacherous tollway. Good God! Pure danger! When he drove it regularly for his business, he was almost killed multiple times. Something about the Texas 8 tollway that brought out the worst in drivers. Still, Charlie continued on what he believed was the most important mission of his life. As he drove the wheelchair, a song came back to him. One that he had first heard at the USO concert in Seoul, South Korea. It was a song that Barbara Mandrell sang that night. One that she said she had just recorded. He would play it many hundreds of times when he was with the Do-Rights. The solo steel guitar section was always one he loved to play, making the instrument echo the heartbreak Barbara was singing into the song. A favorite song. Playin' Around with Love.